I think there is a need today to be very crystalline about what it is that the UN is seeking to do, what it serves, and how it serves in each of the spaces it wants to be active, present, and substantively engaged. And be clear, maybe in a more limited sense, about what's likely to happen, what that effort is likely to lead to.
Welcome to this episode of Multilateralism Unpacked, the podcast of the United Nations University Center for Policy Research. I am David Passarelli, Director of UNUCPR, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Adam McCauley, a journalist and visiting professor at the University of Ottawa with many years of government experience in Canada. Adam McCauley is a close observer of international organizations and how they respond and adapt in moments of crisis. In his role as a non-resident senior fellow at UNUCPR, Adam will apply his expertise to a new initiative, the Global Governance Innovation Platform. This initiative explores and visualizes innovative governance practices that can serve as templates for new multilateral institutions and platforms, or inspire reforms to existing institutions. Adam, welcome to Multilateralism Unpacked, and thank you for taking the time to speak with our audience about this unique political moment, which we might say is defined by a profound questioning of the feasibility of international cooperation through multilateral institutions. In the face of this new skepticism, senior leaders across the UN are making a concerted effort to rethink the organization's shape and functions to make it more agile, efficient, and responsive to the challenges facing the international community. We're delighted to have you here with us today to discuss how organizations can adapt, learn, and withstand direct challenges that threaten them.
Oh, it's lovely to be here.
Since the pandemic, the UN and its member states have launched an impressive effort to retool the UN so that it can better respond to global challenges. This builds on decades of success, brokering compromise and cooperation in a number of technical domains, from telecommunications to education, food to nuclear fuel. The International Peace Institute's Multilateralism Index for 2024 found that while the rhetoric of multilateralism in crisis is widespread, there has not been a major drop-off in participation by states in the multilateral system. Nevertheless, calls for change have grown significantly louder since the release of this index. The UN Secretary General launched just a few months ago the UN 80 Initiative. This initiative is attempting to make the UN more coherent and more efficient, but it is also casting a spotlight on the role of member states in growing the ambitions and activities of the organization over 80 years. How can the UN seize the opportunity of its 80th anniversary to adapt, and in doing so, weather new geopolitical headwinds?
It's a daunting moment to be within an organization as wide, as broad, as complex as the United Nations. I think it's important to remember that the UN itself is the product of crisis, right? It is something that was born out of a need to find a way to make complex problems in some ways addressable. And I think that that is a lesson that's endured. It's shaped the trajectory of the organization over time. It's one that hopefully provides some sort of guidance, particularly in those dark moments. But it isn't to say, and it isn't to downplay the importance and the complexity of this present moment. With a lot of things and a lot of assumptions being challenged in ways that we haven't thought before. The need to think about adaptation and learning, for instance, in new ways has never been more profound and required. The question that I frequently come to, or at least the questions that often come to mind when presented with such a challenge or to wrap your head around such a challenge as the UN might be undertaking at the moment, is to really distinguish between what we mean when we say adaptation and learning in this space. If we want to build robust and rigorous institutions that can deliver particular types of ends, then we need to understand that part of this is recognizing the need to change given the means that you have, given the resources that are in play, which I think more or less captures what we often talk about when we think about adaptation. There's a deeper and I think more philosophical challenge here when we get into the domain of learning. And learning here, we might think of as changes that ask us to think rigorously about the objectives we seek to produce. The UN's objectives across the board are quite expansive and very targeted depending on where you look. And in this present moment, if pressed, I think there's a need to attest for and perhaps review the ways in which these lines of effort kind of work and what it is that we seek to produce.
That's really helpful. And your point about tailoring expectations of an organization with the resources available to it could not be more relevant to this moment. There's a focus on structures at the moment and also a focus on returning to basic principles. For some, this means reducing the number of mandates given to the UN, allowing it to concentrate its efforts for the biggest impact. One way of approaching this is to look for efficiencies across the organizational structures and a reduction of mandates. Those efforts are currently underway. But I want to spotlight an initiative that has been ongoing for several years, which offers another way to think about adaptation in a multilateral institution. Think back to 2023. This Secretary General launched the UN 2.0 agenda, which looked at a systematic set of changes across the organization with the goal of modernizing the UN. This became known as the Quintet of Change and included a focus on innovation, data, digital, foresight, and behavioral science. It speaks not only to a focus on structures, but also to a focus on culture. What do you think the role of culture plays in supporting change in a multilateral institution, supporting adaptability, and how can that bring about a UN that is more of a learning organization?
I think the challenge is often, and it's usually captured in the literature, between maybe considering something like a leader-led reform movement and structurally driven reform movements, right? The theories of change here are different. There are certain things within the remit of a captivating and charismatic leader to reframe, to envision, to suggest and embed in important ways in statements or otherwise that can challenge and or force staff within an organization to rethink some of these essential challenges, perhaps to break out of and free from previous assumptions that no longer hold, or to be specific and granular about how each of the mechanisms at play actually produce particular effects, and maybe be honest sometimes in the sense that solutions today become problems tomorrow, and how do you deal with that, those implications? That theory of change is, I think, useful to keep in mind, particularly when we think about the organization as a brick and mortar institution with a staff and a mission and a set of shared norms and practices, perhaps developed over time. The hazard, unfortunately, when we think about it in those terms, is that the ways in which individuals get into that building might be true, tested, and more or less patterned, which means that the types of people that show up each and every day have seen the world the same way for a long period of time. And in a moment of change or flux, perhaps that's not useful in the same substantive sense. This is, I think, juxtaposed with theories of change that suggest organizations are really responsive to the world outside their walls, that major shifts in geopolitics are going to determine in ways, I guess, more essential and necessary, the direction of that organization than anybody inside that building is going to be able to sort of affect. And I'm not certain it's either or, right? I think it's a mix. It's one and. But the question becomes, especially with an organization like the United Nations, where its central body and secretariat is itself an organization in the proper sense, but its members are states with their own interests not always aligned. How you figure out how to translate change, how you communicate that change, how you align incentives around a changing set of problems is obviously a monumental task and one that we're facing at the moment.
Adam, we've been discussing a significant period of change at the UN. You come to this challenge with many years of experience both in the defense industry, but also through your writing, thinking internationally, but drawing on insights from your national context in Canada. What lessons can we take from your experience that we can apply to understanding the principal-agent relationship you've just outlined?
It's a good question. And I think, you know, one uses analogies or historical cases with care. Context matters immensely in this respect. That said, I think it's also important to distinguish between maybe two different types of functions within an organization like the United Nations. And there are those, and I think there's ample literature today to suggest that the components or instruments within the UN that are probably most durable tend to be those that are most technical, right? There are specific ends that they need to deliver. Their left and right handrails, as it were, are very clear. Their expectations, and the expectations that is the UN has of those entities, but also the member states has of those same actors, are more or less aligned. What becomes challenging is when we move out of that technical space and into this, let's call it a satisficing political space, how we figure out how to play this game together cooperatively, perhaps amidst a moment where multilateralism kind of as an ethos seems to be as thin as we've ever seen it. Now, I guess the insight from kind of the defense and or military or even the strategic side would tend to be, this is precisely the moment where you have to be laser focused about the things you think you can affect and the changes you think you can provide. In this way, perhaps that's why technical institutions within this environment tend to be better performers or at least seen as being more useful. But it isn't to say we can't find common ground amongst member states, right? What we're likely to see, and I think it's been more or less evident in the history of the United Nations, is that it's a coalition of coalitions, small groups, a nucleus of which is very much geared towards providing a certain end or outcome, will work together collaboratively in ways that we wouldn't necessarily have expected, but because it was in their interest to do so. In this moment, it isn't to say that we can't cooperate, but we just have to be very clear about how we're cooperating together and what it is that cooperation can generate. Because there also has to be a value proposition for the UN itself, for its actors, members, and otherwise to play this game. And in the thinnest sense, organizations are always there in some ways to help with the efficiency problem, right? It is a way in which we can pool costs. We can commonly meet and agree upon agenda items and ways forward or lines of effort. And it is a space in which generating common interests may or may not be possible. That's something, you know, more or less up for debate at any given point in time. And that's a real value to the organization as a whole. However, I think there is a need today to be very crystalline about what it is that the UN is seeking to do, what it serves and how it serves in each of the spaces it wants to be active, present, and substantively engaged, and be clear, maybe in a more limited sense, about what's likely to happen, what that effort is likely to lead to. And in sort of reverse engineering from that ideal end state, even if it is small, even if the deliverable isn't nearly as wholesome as we'd like it to be, that's still a value add or a value proposition that the UN could stand behind.
You've helpfully described this moment as a moment of potentially thin multilateralism, but you've also pointed out the effectiveness and the value of coalitions. We're seeing a huge amount of imagination and indeed reimagining of coalitions, an appetite to reach across traditional divides, to seek common ground with new partners, and this is generating a lot of interest in how coalitions come together, how they can impact the mission, vision, and implementation of programs at the UN. What do you think the role of middle powers can be in these coalitions, and how can they hold these coalitions together and foster change at the UN while it's trying to narrow down its mandates and focus on greater impact?
I think the shifting dynamics at the macro level in the international system are important to understand, right? If we do think that thinning multilateralism will produce perhaps a re-engaged or a reinvestment, as it were, of great powers in trying to produce spheres of interest in different ways, then there's a certain category of state out there that can play kind of the glue role within this environment, right? That can find those thin or liminal spaces where common ground can be found between what might be emerging blocks with very different, let's say, political interests in the extremes, but to say, look, together and collectively, particularly given the fact that globalization has tied states together in ways that have necessitated organizations today in ways that, you know, we wouldn't have seen 50, 60 years ago to begin with, those middle powers play a really, I think, vital and critical role if we seek to preserve that international domain where cooperation, consensus building, shared understanding is to be preserved. And if we think, and I think it's right to assume, that the challenges of our future are both complex and interdependent in ways that we're not going to be able to go it alone, then there might never be, or there may have never been, a more important point than this one for middle powers to really double down where great powers, you know, for lack of a useful term, unfortunately, great powers may be trying to pull apart and to designate where the ends of their interests are.
Adam, let's now look to the future. We are confronted with a number of challenges on the horizon. We know that we're operating in a constrained development financing environment. And as you just pointed out, there's an intensification of rivalries amongst great powers. What gives you hope that we can come together in cooperative ways to agree on action agendas that will allow us to effectively address what we know will be significant shared global challenges on the horizon?
It's a huge and good question, and I'm going to come at it from a slightly oblique angle, perhaps. Is one of the things that I find challenging about framing this new terrain, as it were, and this new moment, is I think an overemphasis on efficiency. And the reason I think that this is a limiting characteristic in this conversation is that the provision of public goods is never efficient. Collective and common goods are inefficient by design, and institutions are designed to reduce costs, but by no means would I presume that they were efficient in what they do. And so there is, I think, a movement, especially in the organizational literature and the management literature, to try and optimize, which makes sense. And in very narrow spaces where overhead can be reduced, where lines of effort can be clarified, where the numbers of bodies perhaps can be reduced and still produce the same effects, efficiency is a useful tool. But at the macro level, to talk about the UN as being efficient, I think misses the point. It's precisely because it's inefficient. It's inefficient in ways that allows us to think about costs in the future. It's inefficient in the ways that it allows us to think about where we can maybe sacrifice immediate interests for common collective interests, which may generate positive or pro-social benefits for us in the longer term. All of those things are not economically efficient practices, but they're socially, politically, and developmentally essential practices.
Adam, this conversation has been very helpful in framing this moment as a moment of opportunity and encourages us to think about organizational culture and its role in shaping change and driving adaptation, particularly in an external geopolitical context that could influence the UN's evolution in years ahead. We really look forward to your upcoming paper that is going to focus on these themes, themes of adaptation and atrophy in international organizations, homing in on the question, how organizations learn to change. It's been a real pleasure having you with us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to be here, and I'm so pleased that I can be a part of this program.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Adam McCauley. Look out for more insights in his upcoming paper at unu.edu/CPR.